Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Wandering Road Podcast. I'm your host Chris, and co-hosting with me today is my buddy Aaron again, filling in for Dean, who's out having a great time in Japan. Would be nice if he brought us back some souvenirs, like some samurai swords and stuff, or maybe something from the Pokemon Center. But today we're going to be talking about the end of days. I find this topic particularly interesting because if you ever watch the History Channel, that's all they ever fucking put on there. So, should be a fun one to get into. But before we start today's show, if you have any paranormal experiences that you would like to share with us, please email your stories at twroadpodcast@gmail.com. And if you would like to be on the show and share some of your stories and experiences, again, please reach out to us at twroadpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you and would love to have you as a guest on our show. And with that, we'll start today's show. How you doing today, buddy?
Good, man. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. It's a Friday. It's a good Friday night.
Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th. Yes, we are recording this episode on Friday the 13th.
Talking about you might be hearing Friday the 13th.
Oh man, that is a good point. I didn't notice that. That was, yeah, that's good. That's good. I didn't think about that. To me, it was just another Friday. But yes, folks, we are recording this on October 13th, Friday the 13th. You will probably be hearing this episode sometime in November just because of the way that the schedule and release schedule panned out. But Dean is currently in Japan with his family, having a good old time.
Didn't even send us a plane ticket.
I know. He didn't even offer.
I'm not sure if you've ever seen Parks and Rec. But there's a, I think it's season one, or season six, episode one, where the Pawnee media says that Leslie's just out gallivanting in Europe like some kind of European. So Dean, they're gallivanting in Japan like some kind of Japanese.
That's exactly what he's doing. He did say he was like going to go to like an onsen and all these pretty cool places and museums and whatnot. I hope he gets to the Samurai Museum in Kyoto. I've always been interested in that place. They actually like let you put stuff on, which is pretty neat, and that'd be pretty cool to experience. So I hope he gets to experience some of that crazy historical stuff over there too.
Could you imagine if they let us do that at like the Civil War sites? Be in heaven.
Dude, when we go back to Gettysburg, we have to go to that photography place that lets you dress up in their regalia, and they take they have an old school setup, like the camera and stuff is the same thing that I believe they would have used back in the day.
So to give everybody context, essentially what we're talking about here is what families do at the beach when they go and get their old Wild West photos. Except this one is exactly like the Civil War version of it. So we can dress up in Civil War regalia, do it in the black and white, and they're offering this now at Gettysburg.
Yeah, so it's awesome. So if you guys ever get to Gettysburg, I would totally recommend doing that. Just don't buy any like old weaponry or stuff. They might have attachments to it. But moving on to today's episode, I think we've dilly-dallied enough with non-related material. The end of days, man. This is one of my favorite topics because I don't know about you, but I remember back in the day, the History Channel, at least over here in the States, they had like a multi-episode series on the Book of Revelation. Yep. And they had like some old ass dude in a cave that's supposed to be John of Patmos, like writing. And then they had like all the special effects with the fire, and it's like, oh, the beast will come and it will bear 666. It was so cheesy. But as like a little kid, you're like, what, 12, 10 years old? It's like, oh shit, this is fucking scary. But this topic in general has always fascinated me because based off of what they say within like the books of Revelation and just the concept of end of days, across a few religions, they have some sort of similarities. What are your thoughts on the end of days topic and just in general?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I remember exactly what you're talking about. Those History Channel episodes that always come on, they always had that dark shrouded figure who would walk around and he was the Antichrist. And
right,
he would
parade
right. around, like he'd have one shot in New York City, and then the next one he's over in like LA or Tokyo or whatever. And it's just representation of him going around the globe and just causing like chaos and destruction. So I remember those just kind of like they were yesterday. But yeah, it's really interesting, you know, how you kind of look at what the end of days is, because just one view out of this, whether it be from the Christianity standpoint, from the Islamic standpoint, Hindu, Buddhism, Judaism, whatever it may be, there's so many different elements you can really talk about and different belief systems, what's going to happen, different stories, some of them all tie together. There's a lot of differentiation as well. But kind of when you think about what the end of days is, the first thought that really just comes to my mind is you're going to hear that trumpet blast. And then I automatically think about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Then it's going to be doomsday. And then Jesus rolls in, saves the day. Boom, everybody either goes to heaven or hell, and then that's just the end of existence, which we know that really isn't true. But if you kind of look at it from a general perspective, you almost think that, okay, it's the second coming, here comes Jesus, they're going to wipe out the earth, and then that's it. What do you think about that? Do you kind of assimilate it the same way, or what are some of the general thoughts that you get whenever somebody just says end of days?
And by what you described, that's today's episode. Have a good night, folks.
There's a lot more to it. Trust us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I apologize, my friend. What was your question again?
So just kind of the generalization that I gave there. Like I said, whenever I think of end of days, I just really think about the end of times. So Christ coming back, there being war, there being chaos, and then, you know, Jesus prevailing, and then either everybody goes to heaven or goes to hell. But then that's just the end. It's almost like earth like explodes and there's destruction, and that's the end of humanity. That's kind of what I think about as a generalization of end of times whenever I hear it. Of course, I know that's not what it is per se, but what's your assimilation to the end of times? Like if you had to kind of visualize it when somebody asks you, hey, what's the end of times? What pops into your head? What do you think about?
For me, the first thing that always comes to mind is the Antichrist type of figure. So that can be taken in a couple of ways. The literal Antichrist, like this is the son, I believe the Antichrist is the son of Satan, right? Like a spawn of Satan.
Yeah, I think depending on what religion you look into, but the generalization, yeah, it's the son of Satan.
Yeah, so in Christianity, it's the son of Satan. And in Islam, they call him the Dajjal. Mm-hmm. So when I think of end of days, that's the first thing I think of. Like, who is this figure? Is it a metaphorical figure for how interconnected the world is today? In which maybe, okay, I'm putting my tinfoil hat on, in which maybe the internet is the Antichrist because it has the ability to rally so many people from different nations together under one banner at certain points, depending on what's going on. I'll use a really crappy example. Let's talk about football. And I'm not talking about the NFL. Football, like the tribalism under football, mm-hmm. like how that mechanism can be used to just gather people together and share like one opinion on certain things. But that's the first thing that I think of, the Antichrist. And where is the Antichrist? Who is the Antichrist? Will they reveal themselves as like, hey, I'm the Antichrist? I would hope someone that is that would be a lot more smarter than proclaiming themselves that, because, you know, there are certain militant religious groups out there that are waiting for someone like that to pop up so they could just, you know, pop one in their head. But it would be the Antichrist. I would think of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I would think of the horn sounding.
Big trumpet blast.
The trumpet blast. But I don't really think about the rapture, because I feel like that's, I don't know. I don't know. What are your thoughts on the rapture? I'm like, eh,
Like, that doesn't, it kind of kills the whole concept of End of Days, where everyone has to deal with bullshit. And it's like, no, you select VIPs can leave early. I'm like, oh, that's kind of lame.
So I think what that kind of comes down to is really where you're steeped in your faith. And what I mean by that is, from the Christian perspective, there's actually four different views that come up whenever it comes to what the end of times is. So there's one, it's called historical premillennialism. There's dispensational premillennialism. There's amillennialism. And then there's postmillennialism. And interesting enough is, out of those four, only one, which is dispensational premillennialism, as you can see, easier said than done. Out of those four, that's the only one that actually mentions the rapture. The other three actually kind of bypass it, which I think is very fascinating. And the reason why it does mention the rapture is because that's where it goes into the whole 7-year reign. So this 7-year reign that I'm speaking of, this is when Jesus comes down. He initially rules for 7 years, and then that's before they go to battle with the Antichrist. So from this perspective, this is one that is looked at that is kind of seen as one of the more popular views, but I think it's really hard to be able to kind of conceive the fact that with the rapture, that Jesus just comes down and then there's just all this chaos and there's all this hell and there's all this damnation. But if you look at it from the Islamic perspective, it also makes sense at the same time, because some of the signs that really come up as pointing to, okay, we're going into the end of times, is large amounts of alcoholism. It could be women cheating on their husbands or husbands cheating vice versa. So a lot of infidelity. It's a lot of demonic music, demonic viewing, demonic worship, for example. So all this kind of chaos that we kind of actually see that has been going on probably throughout the last 100 years are all things that are kind of pointed to in terms of really what that start of the rapture is going to be like. But I really think that from the rapturist perspective, I don't know, I kind of have a hard time wrapping my head that there's just all this chaos and war and destruction and death before really, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe that's when it turns into, okay, this is when the second coming comes around, and then we start moving towards the judgment. Is that the right timeline of it?
I believe so. Like, it's the rapture, and then shit hits the fan, and then it's supposed to be the second coming to fix everything, and then it's like, well, like 3,000 years of, like, perfection?
1,000 years.
1,000 years, yeah. Okay, excuse me. And then the day of judgment comes. So that seems to be the timeline. But one thing that I did want to ask you about, because you might have a little bit of more insight than me, is the four horsemen and the seven seals.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know fully about all seven seals. So for example, like 1 through 4 actually identify the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So from that perspective, what these seals are seen as is, seal number 1 is actually a conqueror with a bow and a crown who comes in on a white horse. So this is either seen as Jesus, or different religions actually kind of peg this as being potentially the Antichrist, which I found kind of interesting. I think you can really debunk that one a little bit. But if you see coming in on a white horse, you would automatically think, okay, this is Jesus coming in. Or from the Islamic perspective, the name Mahdi. Or actually, and that's going to be another interesting topic, because depending on where I was reading, kind of as I was going through some of this research, I saw that either Mahdi was Jesus, or there's Mahdi and Jesus. Is there any light that you can really shed to that? Have you read anything along those lines?
It's Mahdi is the Arabic word for the guided one. So this is what the definition says: a Masonic deliverer who will fill earth with justice and restore true religion and usher in a short golden age lasting 7, 8, or 9 years before the end of the world.
So that would be the equivalent of Christ, because that goes into that kind of pre-rapture or almost rapturous stage where Jesus comes down and he reigns for 7 years before Jesus and the angels go to war against Satan and the Antichrist.
Yeah, because in the Quran, they call Jesus Isa.
Isa,
yeah. And the only reason I know that is because I did some digging on Yajuj and Majuj for something completely unrelated to the podcast. A piece of work I'm working on the side on my own. And I came across that name of Isa. And I looked it up and I was like, oh, okay, so this is Jesus. It translates to Jesus.
That makes a lot of sense then. Because seeing those names in different forms, what that means is then there's Mahdi and then Jesus. It's almost like interesting enough when you read really the Islamic perspective through the Quran. Yeah, so you have the first horseman who has a bow and a crown coming in on a white horse. The second horseman rides in on a red horse and has a sword. This kind of symbolizes war and the bloodshed that's about to be able to come. The third horseman carries a balancing scale and rides a black horse. So this really symbolizes famine from the different readings that I really had a chance to take a look at. And then last but not least, the fourth horseman rides in on a pale horse, which is interesting because the pale horse and the fourth horseman actually symbolizes death. So I didn't know what to make of that one there. I kind of thought that maybe three and four would be swapped because the third with the scale rides in on a black horse, but yet death rides in on a white pale horse. So for me, I kind of took that as maybe that's almost like the balancing act in itself, that death is riding in on the white horse or the pale horse, because what that's going to symbolize is this is going to kind of even out. There's going to be death, chaos, and destruction. But on the other side, even though it's not a strict white horse, we know that good is going to be coming about from this. So that's what I had a chance to read up on in regards to the four horsemen and kind of what I've known from that. Do you have anything to add to that in terms of what you know about the four horsemen of the apocalypse?
Regarding the four horsemen of the apocalypse, pretty much the same thing I found based off of my research with death, famine, war, and conquest, which seems to be prevalent all over human history. So one can say the four horsemen are always present with us. But with the other three seals that are left over, the fifth seal is martyrs under the altar. So this says, the opening of the fifth seal reveals the souls of martyrs under the altar, symbolizing the suffering and persecution endured by believers. They cry out for justice and are given white robes, signifying their faithfulness. The sixth seal, cosmic disturbances. The opening of the sixth seal results in cosmic disturbances, including earthquakes, a darkened sun, a blood-red moon, falling stars, and shaking mountains. People hide in fear, recognizing the significance of these events. And the last seal, silence in heaven. When the seventh seal is opened, there is silence in heaven for about a half an hour, signifying the gravity and anticipation of the forthcoming events that culminate in the Day of Judgment.
So from that perspective, what I get out of this is, so the seals from the Christian perspective are actually the equivalent of what the signs of the apocalypse is to come whenever you're talking about from an Islamic perspective. Because the one thing, or actually in the seventh seal, what you had mentioned, and even in the sixth seal mentioned as well, is I believe you said blood red moon. What the Islamic perspective says is actually I might be getting this wrong, but either the moon encapsulates the sun or the sun encapsulates the moon, and essentially it turns a fiery red. Stars instantly drop out of the sky, and also too, mountains float like cotton or clouds, like they're just drifting around in air. So what you had said there for six and seven, that's really fascinating, because that is pretty much an almost spot on similarity that you find in the Quran from what you found on the Bible. And which I think is really kind of something interesting and, you know, important to talk about as well, because with the end of times, like I said, there's a lot of different backgrounds for this. But when it comes to kind of like, if you look at two major religions, Christianity and Islam, there's a lot of similarities between these two in terms of what's written in the Quran and what's written in the Bible. So for you, do you know of any specific similarities that really came about in terms of anything that you have read about or learned about in the past that you found was pretty interesting that is really matching between the two books?
Yeah. And it's not related to particularly to the end of days. It's more so for lack of better terms, the cast of characters involved. So they talk about Mary. They call her Miriam.
Yep.
They talk about Jesus, who they call Isa. So they acknowledge they have angels. The difference between their angels and the Christian angels is that the angels within Islam, they don't have free will. So whatever God orders them to do, they do with his instruction. So those are some of the differences. Well, similarities, but a specific difference when it comes to angels. I know the last pod that we did, we talked about demons. Mm-hmm. There are no demons in Islam.
Right.
They're jinn, which are beings made from smokeless fire, and they were made by God as well. So God made angels, made man, humans, and he made the jinn as well. But yeah, you'll find a lot of similarities between the two. Certain differences you'll see with the hadiths and whatnot, with the rules that they follow. There you'll see some certain differences. But as far as a belief in angels and one God and the acknowledgement of Jesus as a prophet, they acknowledge Jesus was a prophet of God. In their holy text, Jesus was not crucified.
Right.
I believe he was taken to heaven before the Romans could get their hands on him.
Yeah.
Or the Pharisees could get their hands on him.
Yeah, that's it.
Whereas
that's
in our text, he died. Within Christianity, we believe that Jesus is actually the Son of God. Whereas in the Quran and the Muslims, they believe that Jesus is a prophet. So it's not they're saying that he doesn't exist or doesn't play any type of role, but he is one of the prophets of God.
I think that's pretty fascinating in terms of what you said there. And I know we're talking about end of days here, but you brought up a really interesting point there that in the Bible, Jesus was crucified, but in the Quran, Jesus was actually ascended to heaven. He was not, and I could be wrong on this, but he wasn't captured. But even if he was captured, he was not killed. He was just brought up to heaven. In your readings or your studies, is there any reason behind that? Is there any, argument made as to why he was ascended and not killed?
Yeah, so to answer your question, wasn't crucified, nor did he die. But God took him to heaven because of his love for him. So he sent him as a prophet, and he wasn't going to allow him to suffer that fate. And it also says that the Jews themselves violated the law for wanting to crucify him. But they say, having arrested him, they crucified his shadow.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I would like to have a real deep dive with somebody on that from the Islamic faith to get a better understanding of that belief system and why that would be in that manner. But I kind of digress there. Don't want to go too far off topic with it.
But yeah, it would be interesting to get their insights on why that is from their theological perspective.
Yeah, and some of the other similarities I kind of found as I was, you know, kind of reading through and doing research. So both Christianity and Islam, they talk about the day of resurrection, and there's also a day of judgment. They talk about heaven and hell, of course. So heaven being called Jannah, and also hell is called Jahannam. I might be butchering that. I apologize. Jahannam.
There's Jahannam.
That's it. Yep, you got it.
Yeah.
Of course, there's the judgment day is predetermined by God. So in both books, it is predetermined, but a date is not given, of course, which, you know, that's kind of broken down in a lot of different areas. You know, they were saying that it was going to be the turn of the new millennium. So it was going to be the year 2000. A lot of dates pointed to, I think it was it December 21st, 2012? Was that kind of the last big date?
Yeah, with the whole Mayan calendar crap. Yeah.
Yeah, I know there was a lot of emphasis kind of put into that, with 2012 being one of them. Both books announcing that it was going to be brought about, the end of times being signalized by a huge trumpet blast to be able to signal terrible events are coming. Which, again, that's kind of always the first thing that I think about. And I don't know why, but that kind of takes me back to as being a kid, that we were talking originally about like the end of times. And two things that were really prevalent to me as a kid were, number one, the trumpet blast. So literally, like, I always used to think about this. I'd just be out in my yard, and then all of a sudden, just from the heavens, here comes this giant trumpet blast. And then all of a sudden, and I don't remember specifically how I used to think about this, but all I could imagine was literally coming across the sky. I always thought about it more in this perspective, but it was four demonic horses with the horsemen coming after you. And then one of them was just carrying a sword, and then boom, all of a sudden, like, I'm dead. Like, for some reason as a kid, that is something that always pointed out to me, and it always started with that trumpet blast. But the other similarities I came across were, of course, like the rise of the Antichrist, Jesus returns to earth. And also, too, this was really interesting as well. And I didn't really know about this because maybe it's just because maybe I never went too in depth with the reading of it. But also, too, I never remember this being taught when I was going to a Catholic church. But both books actually mention people being killed by Jesus's breath. So I found that really fascinating, that death would be caused by the breath of Jesus. And it's almost like he would be speaking and a large breeze would come across and it would cause death and chaos, death and destruction, or he would actually blow and his breath would actually cause death. So I found that to be a really fascinating point.
Remember last podcast when we were talking about the demons?
Yeah.
And I mentioned that the depiction of Jesus coming down, riding into battle to fight against Satan and his forces on the day of judgment for the Armageddon.
Yep.
He has a sword in his mouth, so he would defeat them with his words.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't even correlate that.
So that's what that refers to. Yep.
Man, talking about tying into podcasts together.
It's a perfect topic segue into one another.
Yeah, and one thing I kind of want to ask you about, because, you know, of course, with similarities, there's also differences as well. I know one thing that really always came across in terms of both the Christian and the Islamic perspective was Gog and Magog. So I wanted to ask you about that. Could you give a little bit of insight into who or what Gog and Magog is?
Yeah, I can definitely do that. So I find the Gog and Magog story or concept to be quite interesting, because from what I know from the Christian text, it's said that, like, after Satan is released from his prison, he's going to deceive the nations from all over the earth, and Gog and Magog are going to gather them into battle. So for me, the Christian side, it's seems like Gog and Magog are his lieutenants. But when you talk about the Islamic text, they call them Yajuj and Majuj. They seem to be a group of people, like this army of people. And according to the text, they say, I believe, yeah, this is in the Quran. When they talk about Yajuj and Majuj, they say that Dhul-Qurnayn stops them. What's interesting is that sometimes people argue that Dhul-Qurnayn is Cyrus the Great or Alexander the Great.
I came across that a lot too, and I didn't get a chance to read too much about it, but I just remember just seeing Alexander the Great, and then it kind of gave them a little bit of context about the Gates of Alexander.
Yeah, so it is said that if you subscribe to the theory that Dhul-Qurnayn was Alexander the Great, that these people came to Alexander and said, there are these heinous, like, tribes of men that they kill us, they pillage, they rape, they eat people, they do all these terrible things. And they plead to Alexander to come and to fight them. So according to, if you subscribe to Alexander being Dhul-Qurnayn, his forces pushes them back, and then they build big-ass wall of iron. And they say that every day, Yajuj and Majuj dig under the wall to try to break through, and every day they fail. And I might be butchering what they really say, but to summarize it, every day they try to break through the wall, and every day God doesn't let them. But one day, God is going to let them, and then they'll break through. And then, like, that starts one of the events of the end times. It's from the Islamic perspective, the Gog and Magog, Yajuj and Majuj, they are terrifying because no army can defeat them. You literally have to run away. They say that there'll be so many of them that when they start drinking from a body of water, by the time the end of their army gets to that, the whole body of water will be dried up. They'll eat everything in sight. They'll kill everything in sight. And after they believe that they conquered the entire world, they'll turn their arrows to the sky and shoot their arrows up at the sky. But what God will do, according to the text, is drop back arrows with blood on it. They'll proclaim, oh, how they defeated the angels. And there'll be no one to stop them. So they'll make the proclamation that they defeated everybody. And long story short, with how they're defeated, Isa, who is Jesus, will make a prayer to God to defeat them. And what he'll do is send like these bugs or whatever and attack their necks, and then they'll all die. That's how they all get defeated. And then the animals of the world will eat them. So it's a really interesting story. Like if you go and look it up and you like watch YouTube videos on it and whatnot, it's a really, really interesting concept.
Question I have, something interesting that came up you said there, was that whenever the arrows are shot into the sky, God will send them back down with blood on them. You said that they were claiming victory over the angels. Is that because the blood was coming down on the arrows? Are they thinking that they'd killed all the angels because the blood's coming down on these arrows?
Yeah, they thought they killed the armies of angels that God had.
Wow.
It's a really interesting story. It is a really interesting story.
Yeah, what I find intriguing about that is the fact that literally nobody can defeat them. And then almost by, like you said, you snapped your finger when you did that, a snap of a finger, God sends down this plague, they get a bite on their neck, and then boom, they're just wiped out.
Boom, they're all just gone.
So one of the things you were talking about as well is you talked about drinking the rivers dry. And talking historically here, I don't know why, but something that always pops into my head whenever I hear that term is Saladin and his army. Whenever they're moving across the desert, they would move from water to water and they would literally drink the waters dry. I found that interesting that you kind of brought that up, especially since we were talking about the Salamic perspective here.
Also, that claim was made against Xerxes' army.
Oh, interesting.
That they'll drink the rivers dry. Drink the rivers dry.
Well, it was funny, too.
Because the Persian army was so big.
It was interesting, too, that when you said that they shot the arrows into the sky, I automatically thought about they're shooting the arrows into the sky and it'll block out the sun.
Oh, right.
But kind of tying it back here. So for Gog and Magog, would you say from the Islamic perspective, are they seen more as... Because the way I guess I kind of understand it is that they're almost seen more of, let's say, like a tribe of people, or would they be seen as individualistic? So two individual people from the Islamic perspective.
From my limited research on them and understanding of that story, it seems like a group of people. They're like a large made up of many nations or millions and millions of people. Whereas with in Christianity, it seems like Gog and Magog are Satan's lieutenants.
Yeah, okay. So I kind of thought the same thing as well, because I was looking at it really from the biblical perspective, where it's seen as Gog and Magog are considered to be nations rather than individuals. And really interesting thing that I came across as well is that throughout the course of the last, you know, 1,000 or so years, that Gog and Magog have actually been attributed to, attested to, whatever word you want to use for it. But the Vikings have been called Gog and Magog. The Huns have been called Gog and Magog. The Mongols, all the way up and through like the Middle Ages, this term was actually being used for these different civilizations or nations. So I thought that was pretty intriguing as well, that all the way up and through the Middle Ages, they were still using Gog and Magog from a big biblical perspective, to be able to talk about these horrific tribes or nations or people.
Because I think that's the only way they could explain it or make sense of it at the time from, I guess, a logical perspective and a theological perspective. Because depending on the time period, you really didn't know what was out there. I'm sure like the average person in Rome didn't have an understanding of what the Asiatic steppe was, you know? So what easier way than the priest to say, well, this is Gog and Magog coming to punish us because we've sinned. Now pay your indulgences.
What's really kind of fascinating about how these are really handed down or how they're written as well is, from the end of times perspective, originally these stories were being written for 7 specific churches throughout Asia Minor. So I always found that kind of fascinating in the sense that kind of the geography and what this is being written for. Because when you think of, you know, whether it be Jesus or Moses or the apostles, we always kind of think of, okay, like Jerusalem, the Arabian Peninsula, kind of being in that area. But when Paul was, I don't want to say excommunicated to Asia, he was kind of putting all this information into 7 specific churches because there was so much negativity going on at the time throughout Asia Minor that he had to preach this to the churches over there and pretty much give a forewarning of what was really coming. And it's not just because we talked a lot about the book of Revelations, that the one thing too is this is not just, yes, like the full story is really given through the book of Revelations about what happens from a biblical perspective, but this goes all the way back to, it starts in the book, I don't know if it starts there, but it's talked about in the book of Thessalonians, the book of Mark, the book of John, even too in the book of Paul. All these different books kind of point to what the end of days is coming. And from that perspective, it's really intriguing that that's kind of given throughout such a span of time, because what you're looking at is these stories really been passed down and written over the course of, what, at least 1,000 years. So it kind of shows like how far back this really dates and where they're getting this information from in terms of kind of what the original message is God has a predetermined date. We're not going to give it to you, but just know this is coming. And that's gone on through probably over the course of maybe about, what would you say, about 3,000 years, maybe a little bit less, maybe around that time frame?
From the Christian perspective, you could say 2,000 years.
2,000 years.
At least from the Christian perspective, it's been about at least 2,000 years, I would say, in which like this story has been able to linger around and change and be interpreted differently. But one thing I wanted to ask you, do you think specifically with the book of Revelation, when it was written, do you think that was pointing towards the end of days specifically, or was it more in reference to what the Christians were experiencing, the early Christians were experiencing under the Roman Empire?
So what you're asking is it more indicative of the times they were in, or is it more being looked at as a futuristic perspective, correct?
Yeah, more indicative of the time that they were in.
That's a really good question. I mean, I think you could really make the argument for both points, but I would say because of the religious persecution going on at the time, I think you could really make a solid case to say it was being written from what was going on. And maybe they were looking at it from, okay, this isn't going to happen instantly on this day, but 100 years from now, this is what's going to happen, because they were going through so many atrocities. They were being, you know, just really treated so poorly by the Romans during that standpoint, that you could easily say that this is more of a current really timeline for it. Now, I will go on the other side and also give some credence to the futuristic standpoint, because if you look at it from how a lot of this information has really been disseminated, a lot of it falls around the millennium. And if you look at when the book of Revelations was written, it was written at least around, I think, the latter parts of the first 100 years AD, going up through, let's say, what, the second century. So it could be the early parts of the second century. So I think from that standpoint, you could also make the case that they were looking more futuristic and saying, okay, if we're looking at the millennium, this is going to be the future. Not saying it's going to be 2,000 years from now, like a lot of people were predicting in the year 2000, but could also be in the year 3000. So I would say you can look at it from both perspectives, but I think that's a really fascinating point you bring up about the current times that they were in and the persecution they were facing against the Romans. What are your thoughts on that?
I look at it from the perspective that they were writing about what they were going through at the time, because like Nero was crucifying them at the games and setting them on fire. They were blamed for the great fire in Rome that engulfed like what, half the city, which I think Nero was responsible for, that piece of shit. Yeah, I think you could take it twofold, that they were talking about what they were dealing with at the time, but also kind of putting a warning to the Romans and basically everybody else, saying that, yeah, you could keep doing this, but this is going to happen. Like, Jesus is going to come back and you're all going to, essentially, you're all going to get your just desserts.
So I think that brings me to an intriguing question. is, so let's say we go based off of that premise. Is that being used in true belief, or is that being used as a scare tactic? Because I think it kind of goes back to our last podcast that we were talking about this whole sense of belief that, you know, if you're a true believer, then you don't have to worry about the end of times. You know, we kind of hit on that a little bit. But in that sense, I think that kind of opens up a little other loophole to say, we're out here preaching this. This is what we believe. But maybe if they don't believe in their heart, they're like, hey, we can say this to the Romans and we can put the fear of God in them. And maybe this will change their mindset and they'll start treating us better.
Yeah, that is a good point. Now, this might be an unpopular opinion for everyone that loves talking about Revelation and how doomsday's coming. Thinking as a historian, like if I'm analyzing this text, what is the purpose of it? Why was it written? When was it written? Who is the target audience? Yeah, I view it as this is a warning. Stop your shit. Leave us alone. If you don't want to burn in hell, essentially convert and join us. That is the most objective analytical perspective I could take on that topic.
No, that's a really good point you actually bring up there, is not only one, trying to get better treatment, but also two, use it as a conversion method. So that's a really good point you just brought up there. And I think what I'm kind of curious about as well, so you were mentioning, is it based off of current times or are we talking futuristic? Is also to think about what they had just come off of. And without it looking off the top of my head, but I believe the book of Revelations was written anywhere from, I think it was 64, 65 AD, maybe even up to like 84, 85 AD, maybe in that time frame. But even if you take that into context, the death of Jesus at that point would have only occurred 30 to 50 years prior to this. So I wonder also, and chime in if you have any thoughts on this, but I wonder if they're also thinking during our lifetime, we've seen the death of the Savior, and we've also seen or heard about the ascension as well, or him coming back after being dead for 3 days. I wonder if they're also thinking that, okay, we're going through this. He sees what we're going through, and he's going to be coming back anytime now. They're more thinking short-sighted, saying, okay, we've already seen this in our lifetime. He's going to come back soon, and he's going to save us, or he's going to right the wrongs.
I can see it from that perspective. That's how I would view it as well, from the non-religious perspective.
Because I know if it were me, kind of being in that time, and whether being present or just hearing these stories and being a believer of the Christian faith, I would assume that God would come back to be able to save me. And you can look at it from a different perspective. You can look at it from that. You can look at it from text, because it took God how many hundreds of years to come through and free the Israelites? They were in bondage for 400 years. So it could be from that perspective as well. But I think from them, they're thinking, okay, this can really happen anytime, and it's going to happen soon.
Because if you think about it, they're just, for the longest time up until, I would say, the conversion of Constantine, they were persecuted. Sometimes they were persecuted more horribly than other times. I think it depended on the emperor. But I think for a group of people that are being persecuted, they needed to have something to latch on to give them hope.
And that makes a lot of sense as well, because if you think at it from the perspective of Constantine, really being a lifelong pagan and really devoting himself to Christianity on his deathbed, that's almost seen as him being, and I'm not going to say this, I don't want this taken out of context, but he did this not because of his faith or his belief, because he just didn't want his empire falling apart. So he did it from the perspective of saying, listen, I need to unite everybody. We need to bring it under one banner. This is what I need to do. So that also makes a lot of sense from that perspective. So yeah, I guess you could look at it from a lot of different angles.
There were a couple things that I wanted to ask you, which we didn't have notated for today, but we'll start with the whole concept of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
What's your perspective on that? Because the traditional view of the beast is that it's some sort of giant creature that's going to come up from the water and have like these three heads and all these frickin' eyes, and it's going to be terrible for me because I have trypophobia, and it's going to be this mechanism for, I think, the Antichrist, right?
Yeah.
To get rid of people that don't submit to him or take the mark of the 666. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's just metaphorical? Like, what are your just general thoughts on that concept of the beast?
It's hard to really tie down, because if you look at it from, let's say, just a general standpoint, you can take it for what it is. When you hear the beast, like you mentioned, it could be a Cerberus. It could be some kind of mythical creature that really just comes about. It could be anything that you can really think of.
Brock Lesnar.
Brock Lesnar, the beast incarnate. You could even make the case that the beast is the Antichrist. And what I mean by that is, because like you said, is it analytical? Is it a physical creature? Like, you could also make an argument to saying the beast is in all form and actuality, it is the Antichrist itself. That can kind of be all encompassed in one meaning. And who knows, if that's the case, you could literally say, okay, this person literally has a mark on them. It's the mark of the beast, the 666, for example. So never really put too much thought into the analytical and thinking of what the true meaning of what the beast is. I think I kind of look at it overall from an arcing perspective, is I kind of use the beast as the term of what's actually going on in the present day. So what I mean by that is not what's going on present day now, but what's going on at the time, and meaning anarchy. So the beast would represent the infidelity, like we were talking about before, the Islamic scriptures talks about high alcohol use. It could be talking about satanic rituals, satanic worship. So I think from my perspective, I don't think it's going to be a physical or mythical creature. I don't even believe it maybe to be one person, but I kind of would assimilate that the beast is kind of the overall negativity in society that's going on, that is actually leading to the second coming of Jesus to be able to right those wrongs. What are your thoughts there? What's your thoughts on the whole, you know, marking of the beast and the beast itself?
I think that the concept of the beast, I too don't think like it'll be like a Leviathan type of creature.
Batista.
Freaking the Leviathan Batista. I think it's a culmination of things that these organized religions condemn to be sinful or heretical that have been allowed to run rampant in their perspective. So that could be what the beast is supposed to represent, as opposed to, you know, how these, I hate even giving them airtime. I'm going to have to go there. These people that think vaccines are the mark of the beast, stupid shit like that. Like, no, it's not the fucking mark of the beast. There's not going to be a mark of the beast. No one is going to ask you to engrave 666 on your fucking forearm. And if you do that, you're a fucking moron. But it's basically saying that the beast is all of these different things that combined together just cause chaos and disruption from the religious perspective of said organized religion. If that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. And I think literally that's probably a discussion that you can have in terms of breaking down of what the actual meaning of that could really be. But you kind of helped me also really segue into another area in terms of generalizations. Because when you're thinking about kind of the holicity of what this end of days process is, I think one area that I always really found fascinating was the resurrection. And if you look at it from the biblical perspective, is they talk about that both all of the world, meaning all of the world, both the dead and the undead, are going to be resurrected or judged. So you're bringing that into the judgment, which kind of, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong here in terms of how I am analyzing this, but I kind of take it for face value that when it's saying that judgment is going to be brought upon for both the dead and the undead, that kind of seems to me like that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And here's why, is because growing up as a, I will say, I guess, devout Catholic, you're always taught that you die, And then you go when you have your judgment, and then you go to heaven or hell. So what I never really understood was, from this perspective, how are you being judged again if Christ is raising the dead and going through another judgment? Does it mean that they are actually being judged, or all souls are finally being raised to heaven? Because then you can look at it and say, okay, well, there's souls that might be roaming around in purgatory, for example. There's souls that might have went to hell who maybe have been wrongly judged, which, again, that doesn't really make sense to me. But I always kind of found that fascinating that they said that souls of the dead and the undead will be resurrected and judged. What do you make about that?
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a concept that has always boggled my mind. Someone dies. Let's say, for example, someone that's been a devout Christian their entire life. They never did anything bad. They die. Technically, they should be in heaven, right? Because under the belief of Christianity, they believe, well, I fall in that category, that Jesus died for our sins, right? Why would that person, if they're already in heaven, have to come back and be judged again? Or are they all just like on this massive line waiting in this big ass waiting room? Like waiting to be judged, like, okay, all right, guys, in 20,000 more years, we're all going to come back, and you're going to have to pick your number and get on the line, and then we'll let you know if you got to go to purgatory, or if you got to go to heaven, or if you got to go to hell.
I like how you just became an old lady on a supermarket microphone, or...
I mean, really, how else does that make sense? Unless that is applied to the dead that were virtuous. Let's call them virtuous pagans, because that's what they call them in Dante's Inferno, right? Limbo, that's for the virtuous pagans, your philosophers and stuff. So I gave this example to Dean before on a previous podcast, where we talked about the afterlife. The year is 300 BC, right? There's this monk, this Buddhist monk, living in the mountains, living in the fucking Himalayas, just lives in his temple, just eats, sleeps, and prays, and meditates all day. Doesn't drink, doesn't have sex with hookers, doesn't do anything wrong. He dies. Throughout his entire life, he's helped kids, he's done this, he's helped animals, he's never killed anyone, vegetarian their entire life. That person dies, but because they lived in a certain time period that they didn't know of Christianity and they didn't know of Jesus, do they go to hell for that? Or do they go to limbo? And those souls that are in limbo or in purgatory, well, I don't want to say purgatory, because purgatory is a place for you to purge yourself of your sins. And it doesn't sound like a nice place. That person, where do those people go? So I'm assuming when they say they raise the dead for the final judgment, I would assume it would be for people like that.
I can see the point you're really making there, because kind of looking at it as well. So they had mentioned that, you know, like early pagans, for example, their souls immediately, and you'd kind of reference there with Dante's Inferno, they immediately went to the underworld. And that could be just because of not a belief in Christ or Christianity, for example. I think then it also opens up the question that, you know, let's say that this is the whole premise that maybe not everybody goes to heaven right away, or that you're kind of waiting for the second coming, which kind of is in a very, very similar perspective. I always used to think about this, because before Jesus came back from the dead and he ascended into heaven, prior to that, there was a general belief throughout the church that when you died, you weren't necessarily going to heaven, or you were just kind of in limbo until Christ came back. And I can kind of see what you're saying there, but interesting enough, this was kind of taught this way in the Byzantine Catholic Church, that some of the priests that I had kind of mentioned that until, and even too, it's depicted like this in some art, which is very interesting. But what it shows is that really, whenever you died until Jesus came to earth and then ascended into heaven, it's almost like you were dead and then nothing happened, which kind of is very counterintuitive to what you read in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament as well. But I think if what you look at it from the resurrection standpoint is that if, let's say, the dead and the undead are coming back to being judged, and you have this premise that, okay, maybe you don't go to heaven right away, but then it just opens up a whole can of worms from somebody who, let's say, is like on the fence about belief, saying, well, what about all these stories whenever people die and then they see this flash of light, they see their loved ones and they see heaven and they talk to God, you know, all these different things. So I don't know. I always just found it kind of interesting with that reading in terms of being able to open up this whole, let's say, wormhole in regards to how that can be depicted and broken down.
Yeah, that is a good point. And it makes me ask the question, do like really terrible people go to that limbo state too? Or are they just like auto-banned to hell? Like, dude, like you're a fucking piece of shit like Hitler. Like, just go. Like, you don't have to wait for the day of judgment.
Right.
You're a fucking piece of shit. I'm just going to toss your ass and let them stab you with pitchforks and stuff for all eternity. Like, that's what you're going to deal with. But I can see the point that you make. But that brings up the question of questioning the whole concept of Jesus dying.
Yes.
Because if he died for your sins, why do you have to wait in limbo for him to come back for you to be judged? Yeah, I can see how that can become an issue.
Definitely. Here's the one positive to take away from this. While we can sit here and be analytical and break all this down, we both know that you and I are believers. So whenever that time comes, we don't have to worry about that shit. We know where we're going.
You sure about that, man? You sure about that? Have you heard our mouths when Liverpool concede a goal?
Well, you keep wearing that SPQR shirt around all the time. I don't know where you're going. Talking about Roman and religious persecution. You're living it right now, buddy.
No, I'm not. It's for the glory of Rome.
That's right.
They're separate. But there were a couple of things I still wanted to ask you. I want to circle back to the Antichrist concept. I know we talked about when you think of the word end of days, what comes to mind? You mentioned the four horsemen. You mentioned the Antichrist. Do you think that the Antichrist is a person, or is it a culmination of things that lead to the destruction? Like, how do you interpret that?
If I'm uber, uber religious, I look at it as this is going to be a one specific person. Because the way it's talked about is it's coming back and there's going to be a physical battle. So now, whether that's one person or it could be a legion of people, regardless, you're putting a physical being in that spot. And I'm glad you circled back to this, because I think that's going to bring up a whole other discussion that you can literally bring up about what does that timeline look like in terms of end of days whenever you talk about the Antichrist. But I think for me, I think it's going to be one person. And I'm going to make a really weird joke here, but I always sometimes also whenever you talk about the Antichrist, do you remember the movie Little Nicky? Do you remember the guy who was almost dressed like an Amish person, but he has that black hat and that black suit and his eyes are rolled back and he's just... running,
yeah.
We're all gonna
die. Yeah.
I don't know why, but if that's gonna be the version of the Antichrist, I would love to get a good laugh out of that before Jesus comes back and kicks his ass. But
you brought up Little Nicky. If you haven't watched that movie, go watch it, because we can't talk about it. It'll get us canceled.
Yeah.
Today's world.
Yeah, please go watch it. It's not the best of his movies, but you're still going to get a big laugh out of it. I think if I look at it from a religious perspective, I think it's really going to be a physical person in itself. I hope that, of course, that's not in our lifetime, because I would hate to really see one person be able to rise up to be able to have that much power to be able to cause a situation like that to be able to happen. But I think it really kind of also leads to, like, what does that timeline look like? Because throughout our lifetime, well, not through our lifetime alone, but it could be the lifetime of two or three generations in our families, that you have had people throughout the 1900s into 2000s. You've had your Hitlers. You've had the wars that have gone on. You've had literally like Nazi society in terms of how it was going. You have different, I'll say, affiliations, organizations, whatever you want to call them, the KKK. Like, you have all these different groups, people, organizations, whatever has happened. And yet nothing has yet to happen. So I think for me, it kind of begs the question, what has to be done for this to finally happen? Like, and I think that's where I kind of, that's where my questioning always comes in. And I don't mean questioning in a bad way, but on our last podcast, I talked about as a child, I used to question things a lot. But it kind of like [S2] Right. [S1] Raises a question of, yes, I know there's a predetermined date, but also too, it makes me think, like, is God placing this one person or these people in place that things are just going to get so bad that it's going to trigger off this situation of events? And it's like, you can tie it into wrestling. Like, you get a super bad heel who comes in, and then boom, here comes the baby face to save the day, and everything's all good, you know? So I think that's kind of my thought. Is it going to be a predetermined person that comes through and does this? Or is it something to where God just really plans these chain of events and all these different situations that happen that's going to lead up to be able to come in and solve that? I mean, I hope that answered your question. I think I kind of went a little general there, but I hope that made sense for you.
Yeah, definitely did.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts? Do you think it's more somebody who is like individualistic? Do you think it's a group of people? Do you think it's a chain of events? Do you think it's kind of like civilization as a whole? Like, what side of the fence do you sit on?
So with this particular thing, I know sometimes because of my academic background, I can be wishy-washy. I kind of sit in the middle with certain things, but with this, maybe it's a person, and not in the sense that this dude, like, or lady or whatever, is the direct descendant of the devil, but of a highly intelligent person that knows how to manipulate people to get what they want, to get to a certain place of power that allows them to go unchecked. Because I think one of the hallmarks of the Antichrist is that they'll bring about world peace. And who's really going to challenge someone that just brought about world peace and unification? Right. I mean, honestly, you'd automatically be beaten down as a warmonger. So I don't think it'll be. So I think it'll be maybe a person or a group of people that are highly intelligent, that are well connected, that can manipulate the world situation to get it into a place where they can essentially do what they want to do unchallenged and unchecked. Because if you try to check them, they'll be like, well, I just brought global peace. I just ended world hunger. What did you do? You're just complaining. Like, why are you praying to some deity? Why are you praying to God? Why are you doing this? They didn't bring world peace. I did. Mm-hmm. So that's how I view it in that sense. It could be a person or it could be a group of people.
Well, in your scenario, I will tell you that's not FSG bringing Liverpool to the promised land.
No. John Henry's the fucking Antichrist in this club.
Maybe that'll get a
cheap bastard.
That'll get a good chuckle out of some of our European listeners.
Right? That fucking cheap bastard.
Oh man. But no, I was just gonna say, kinda as we're wrapping up here, were there any other topics or areas that you kinda wanted to go through or cover?
I did have one general question. Mm-hmm. Do you think I'll humor the tinfoil hat people. Do you think we're living in the end of days?
If you again, I'm going to go back to the analytical side of this. If you look at it from religious texts, yes, we are 100%. And not only are we living in it, but we've been living in it for decades now. And it just keeps getting...
The 90s don't count. They were glorious.
Well, I guess really then it must have really been the glory years in the 80s with all the coke and everything going around.
I'm sorry, but continue.
I would say, honestly, I mean, again, from a religious perspective, if you look at it for religious texts, yes. But also, too, I think you can really say that about any point in time. You can go back to the 1800s and you can point to the Civil War. You can point to the War of 1812. You can go to the century before that and you can look at the American Revolution, the French and Indian War. I mean, there's going to be any point in time where you can point at it and you can look and say, yes, we're living in it. So from a biblical standpoint, I would say, yes, we are. Or from a religious standpoint, we are. But from a general perspective, just based off of what we can say over the last, let's say, 500 years, I really don't think we are. And I think this kind of goes back to the last question of, if we are living in that time, how bad do things have to get before this triumphant return, this second coming occurs? So I would say that would be my kind of answer, kind of like what you were just mentioning in your last piece there, that I'll sit on both sides of the fence there. If you look at it from a religious text, excuse me, yes. But from an analytical standpoint, just thinking about what we're going through, no. Because it always just seems like maybe things can always be worse, I guess. And maybe that's just the optimist in me. But you always feel like, okay, like, yes, we have this going on, but it could always be 10 times worse than that. So what are your thoughts? Do you think we are kind of living in these times, or where do you really sit on that?
I don't think so. I think if we did live close to the end times, things would be a lot worse. I think there would be more wars. I know there's a shit ton of wars going on, but I think there'd be like a massive world war. There would be all of these terrible things going on amplified, if that makes sense. I think all the crappy shit that's going on right now, it would be more amplified. But who knows? We might be in a situation where it's the start of it. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't necessarily mean that next week the four horsemen are going to show up. I think if you look at it from a religious perspective, it'll probably happen in phases. So that's how I view it. I'm of the same mind. I think it's not literal, it's more metaphorical. You could look at any time period in history and say, fuck, these were the end times.
Yeah, and if you look at it too, it depends on what time you're sitting in, because you have Christ comes down and he inherits the earth for 7 years initially. But then once he defeats the devil, then he rules the earth as a natural being for 1,000 years. So I guess it all comes down to is what point in time are you also looking at it as well? Or are we looking at it from the standpoint of, are we going to be in the chaotic standpoint? Are we going to live in the rapture? Is it during the tribulation? Is it during the resurrection? Is it during the judgment? So all from that standpoint. But I think at the end of the day, I think when you break it down and you think about the end of days, the first thing you think about is it's going to be the start. It's going to be the tribulation. It's going to be that trumpet blast. It's going to be the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And then it's going to be all hell breaks loose. And then here comes Jesus to save the day with that sword in mouth.
Watch that happen literally on the last day of the season, when we're about to go undefeated.
And win the league. Late.
Hit 100 points, undefeated Centurions. Watch that shit fucking happen. Like, it'll be like in stoppage time, we're about to seal the title. And then you'll hear the trumpets horn. And the commentators will be like, did somebody blow the final whistle? Oh, no. Look, Peter. It looks like angels are coming down from the sky. It's been nice knowing you. Unfortunately, this league campaign has come to a stop, and it's now null and void until the apocalypse is over.
And here's where we're going to gain more European or soccer followers is actually it's going to be when FSG go to sail the club, and literally when they're about to sign on the dot, here comes the trumpets. And then, oh, none of this matters anymore.
Was there anything else you wanted to touch up on before we wrapped up today's show, man? I think this was a good fun conversation. Literal religious belief. We touched on similarities between end times. We sprinkled in our own beliefs here and there. Is there anything you wanted to wrap up with?
No, I think it's been a really good discussion because, like I said, we look at it from more of the Christianity and the Islamic perspective. Like I said, kind of at the beginning of this podcast, there's so many different routes you can look at it. You can look at it from a Judaic perspective. There's a Hindu perspective. You can look at it as a Buddhist. There's so many different stories. But at the end of the day, it all comes down to one thing, is there is going to be an end day. There is going to be a second coming. There is going to be a judgment. So from that perspective, no matter what you believe in, that time is coming. And no matter when it is, we just need to be prepared for it.
And while you're preparing for that, don't forget to rag on the hag.
Rag on that hag.
Thanks for tuning into today's episode of The Wandering Road. You can find us on Apple, Google, Spotify, and most podcast platforms. Be sure to subscribe and share. Also, don't forget to give a follow on Instagram at @twroadpodcast and follow my TikTok at @twrpodcast. Take care, and I'll catch you on the next one.